Welcome back, everyone.
I'm Nicole.
And I'm Crystal. You're listening to Las Brujas and Friends podcast.
A podcast where we talk about legends and paranormal stories, sprinkled with true crime, extraterrestrial, and the like.
A little disclaimer, we're not professionals, we're not historians, we just love everything scary.
If you haven't already, which you should have, subscribe to and review this podcast.
So in today's episode, I will be covering The Exorcism of Emily Rose. Well, not the movie, but the origin of that story. Well,
the film kind of plays it up a lot.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
You're going to get into details.
It's one of those based on a true story. And what are you going to talk about today?
Oh, I'm talking about a true crime.
Oh, you're doing true crime.
I was like, am I doing mystery? No, I'm doing true crime.
Mystery.
So for mine, it is a Valentine's Day true crime story that happened back, and I have to scroll all the way up to 2010. This is a story that was based off of Oklahoma. And we'll let you wait for that one.
Yeah, she's going to go last or second. Last. Last, like there's a line of stories. She's going to go second. Since it's a Valentine's Day theme, we'll save that the best for last.
Yes.
Aha. And I'll go first and talk about exorcism because I messed up. Why didn't I think of that? Hold on, let me turn. I'm going to take a sip of my tea.
Yeah. Mine's a Moscow Mule.
This is a tea. This is ginger beer.
Yep. On the rocks.
With lime. On the rocks with a little bit of salt. Tito's.
Hold the salt.
Okay. If my computer would turn on so I can read my notes.
Oh, so take us way back. What year?
We're not even going that far back. What, we're only going to the 1960s, 1940s. I'll tell you in a second. Okay. Let me pull up my notes.
Didn't do it.
Oh, and by the way, for all of our listeners out there on the podcast or on YouTube, we're all sick in this house.
Yeah.
That's hence the tea. Mine's a hard tea. Yours is regular tea.
Mine's more of a yogi tea.
Yeah, I'm a little bit more over my sickness compared to everybody else in the house right now.
We're now getting it. Through it.
We all had our...
Her ship has sailed. We've now gotten on board of that ship.
I've moved on to a hard tea instead of regular tea. Okay, I'm ready. My computer is ready to go. I'm going to be talking about... Her name is Annalise Michel. She's German. So M-I-C-H-E-L. Michel, right? That sounds German. I don't know. I have no idea what German should sound like. Michel? Maybe Michel. Michel? 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 She's not Spanish. So per usual, how I usually start my stories, I start at the very beginning.
Yep.
So Annalise was born in 1952 in Klingenberg, Germany. She was raised in this very small town, and her whole family were devout Catholics, which... And I don't mean like they went to church on Sundays. They went to mass two times a week, and they had the crucifixes, the rosaries, the photos on the walls. Like, they were devout Catholics. She had three sisters, and then it was her and her parents that lived in this house. And then we're going to fast forward 16 years because there was pretty much no information prior to 16. So in September 1968, she was 16 years old and she passed out at school. She was completely passed out in the middle of school. Her friends and family say that after the fainting spell, she was walking around dazed and she was in a trance-like state. Annalise herself said that she did not remember any of it. So she passed out in school, didn't have any idea that that happened. That night that it happened while she was at home, she told her parents that she felt heaviness on her chest as if something was pinning her down to the bed. Over the next 3 years... Do you ever get
that? No. You never get any type of weight you feel?
Never. Do you?
I feel like I get the ambiance of somebody watching me while I'm walking, if I'm like walking late at night or I'm alone and I feel like someone's there and they're not. That's what I feel.
I mean, I get that, but I'm one of those people that I'm like, leave me alone, and then it goes away.
Walk fast.
walk fast, look down, and just go.
Get your keys.
get your snacks from the pantry and haul ass. Oh my God, no, Troy sent me this meme. Troy just sent me this meme like today or yesterday. Uh-huh. And it's a guy drinking a bottle of water with his eyes really big, looking out to the side. And it says, at night when I'm in the kitchen drinking water, but also looking for ghosts.
Oh my God.
And he wrote, that's me every night. You guys are such scaredy cats. I'm like, no, another story. Oh my gosh, I just thought of this. What? So one night I came down here. Mm-hmm. For some reason, I find myself by myself in this living room at night a lot in the dark.
Doing broomstick challenges?
In the dark. Oh, the broomstick challenge. That was like two nights ago.
Fail.
And our broomstick did not stand up.
Well, ours is at a diagonal. It doesn't work.
No, there were brooms on diagonals like this. Standing up.
They probably got some super glue on it.
People were having so much fun with that. So two nights ago, I was down here trying to stand this broom up, and Nicole turned the lights off on me. And then, okay, so one night when everybody was here, like all the kids were here, I was in the kitchen, and I turned the lights off. I turn around to start walking back up our stairs, and our dining room table is right behind me as I'm turning around with chairs, obviously. And on the chairs was a pair of white pants hanging on the back of it. So when I turned, all I saw was a pair of white pants, and it looked like it was standing in front of me. And I freaked out for a split second. I thought there was somebody standing there. I almost had a heart attack.
Where were the kids?
Everybody was asleep.
Oh.
It was like 1 o'clock in the morning.
Okay.
And I was just like, for a second, I went, like, so there's a ghost. A ghost. There's legs in the kitchen. And then finally, after that split second, when my eyes adjusted, I was like, oh, it's Emily's pants are hanging on the back of the chair. For a split second, I thought I was being haunted. That was not a night where I told the spirit to leave me alone. That night, it almost got me. I got set up. So, okay.
So we're back on it. She's 16. She fainted. She's walking back in school.
And she feels like a heaviness is on her chest. Okay, so over the next 3 years, she kept having these fainting episodes. So after the initial one, in September 1968, she had another one 11 months later. Mm-hmm. This time, she woke up in a trance-like state and wet her bed. Aww. So she was having problems with her bladder. She was also now convulsing, having a series of convulsions. So now it was more like seizure-like symptoms.
Yeah.
Her parents took her to a doctor. They had a family doctor, and then they also took her to see a neurologist. The doctors ran their tests, mm-hmm. and they even did an EEG, a brain scan, and they didn't find any abnormalities. The neurologist, even though there weren't abnormalities that they found in the brain scan based on her symptoms and what she was going through, he diagnosed her with temporal lobe epilepsy. And this disorder causes seizures, loss of memory, and hallucinations. So she was diagnosed with something, and she was prescribed some medication. One was an anti-convulsant medication, and another was an anti-seizure medication. They ran tests on her while she was taking these meds, and everything always came back normal. They ran a test in 1970 when she had another episode. This was her third one. Normal. In 1972, she had her fourth episode, and this time her scan came back with mild irregular patterns, but nothing that could determine a different diagnosis or cause a doctor to link it with something else.
How long did these go on for? 3 years?
3 years, four episodes. She was on medication, still had episodes. The fourth episode, even though she had mild irregularities in her brain scan, there was nothing else the doctor at the time could diagnose her with. So at this point, she's had four episodes, and unfortunately, the medication prescribed to her wasn't helping anymore. Mm-hmm. Her condition continued to deteriorate, and things turned south. She was starting to believe that she was possessed by a demon and that she needed to find help outside of medicine.
If the parents were religious...
Mm-hmm. And she was raised to be very religious.
Yes.
And at this point, she was 16, 3 years later, 19. She's a full adult.
Oh,
she can make her own decisions.
But even then, going through 17, 18 and having this, your parents would at least like be talking to somebody at the church.
Yep. They were. Yeah. In spring 1973... she started to hear knocking sounds in her room. And okay, the medications and her diagnosis does say that she could be dealing with hallucinations, except that her sisters were hearing the knockings on the walls as well. Yeah. So there's no explanation for that. Annalise says she was hearing voices and seeing the devil wherever she went. She said she had demons whispering in her ears, and they were telling her that she was damned and that she was going to rot in hell. So we're in 1973 still. In September of 1973, she had a visit with the neurologist, the same guy. I feel like at this point you should have seeked out second, third, fourth, fifth, other options.
In Germany.
In Germany, yeah.
But this is the 1940s?
No, 1970s. Okay, we got medicine. We got lots of doctors at this point. But again, it was Germany. It was a small town. So maybe they didn't. But maybe she should have tried. Yeah. Stop seeing the same neurologist. This time when she saw him in September, she told him she would have horrific visions of demon faces that were tormenting her, and that she was starting to smell things. And one of the things she said that she would smell was something that she described as burnt feces. I don't know what burnt feces smells like. She also told him that the devil was inside of her. So now she's telling people. I think within her home, like, they already had this idea of her being possessed, but now she's telling her doctors. So according to the mom, she said the neurologist told them to consult a religious official, and a religious official, like a priest.
Yeah.
But later on, the same doctor that the mom claims told them that, he says he never gave them that advice.
That's what I was thinking right now. Because for him to say something like that is not within his method of understanding.
Doctor. Yes. He's not supposed to say that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Not church.
Either way, despite if it was true or not, the family did seek out a priest, and they found Father Alt that same month in September, but he doesn't really start doing anything yet.
Alt contest that the doctor said?
No. Oh. Mm-mm. So they saw him out. He'll come into play later. Okay. A couple months later in November, Annalise met with a Freudian psychiatrist. This psychiatrist diagnosed her as neurotic with possible epilepsy. So I guess it's like, does she have epilepsy? Does she not have epilepsy? But this psychiatrist did say that she was neurotic. So she is dealing with something on a mental level. And I wanted to talk about what epilepsy is, because I'm sure, like me, when I started doing this, I wasn't fully aware of what epilepsy was. So I'm going to explain it to everybody.
Explain it, Lucy.
Epilepsy is a chronic disorder that causes unprovoked recurrent seizures. There are two main types of seizures. Okay. There's a generalized seizure that affects the whole brain, and a focal or partial seizure that affects just one part of the brain. And then here are some of the things that it causes. So it causes spasms, uncontrollable muscle twitches. People can become confused. They lose consciousness. And afterward, you have no memory of it happening.
Hence the blackouts.
Hence what was happening to Annalise.
Yes.
And then, so it also depends on the seizures or what kind of epilepsy you have, if it's affecting just the part or the whole brain. Either way, here's some more things. It can alter your senses. Remember, she was saying she smelled burnt feces?
Yeah.
It alters all of your senses, your touch, your taste, your smell, your sight, everything. It can make you dizzy, twitching, staring blankly, unresponsiveness, performing repetitive movements, loss of muscle control, so you can just all of a sudden fall down. Yeah. Like, you completely lose everything.
Equilibrium.
Stiffening of the body, shaking, loss of bladder or bowel control. Biting the tongue and loss of everything. Yeah. Everything she was experiencing falls under epilepsy. But the medications they had prescribed to her weren't working. So what the heck is going on here?
But maybe during that time too, this was more of a trial and error with epilepsy being...
It's the 70s. I mean, yeah, maybe modern medicine wasn't at its peak. Especially in a small town in Germany.
Yeah.
All right, now you guys have the basics of what epilepsy is. So let's get back to Annalise and her story. So she met with a Freudian psychiatrist, got diagnosed with those diagnoses. She met with another neurologist that diagnosed her with epilepsy and prescribed her stronger medication. She was prescribed Tegretol, an anti-seizure drug, But with every medication comes side effects, right? And she was already dealing with epilepsy, apparently. So this certain drug was also a mood stabilizer, but the side effects can cause suicidal thoughts. There was another medication they gave her, Dilantin. A lot of people bring this up in the story when I did my research. And this side effect, the side effect of this drug includes increased suicidal thoughts and depression. So it's like she was on a mental and physical cocktail of just all bad things. A month after these drugs were prescribed, she continued to tell doctors that she was seeing devil faces, so they prescribed her a drug for schizophrenia. She was on everything.
This poor girl is trying to just have someone listen to her to help her, and they're just like, here you go.
Here's another drug. Here you go. Here's another one.
Here you go.
Yeah. But again, she was a full-grown adult, and she was convinced that she was possessed, and her delusions had become extreme. So in July 1975, her behavior went out of control. This is when it all, like, just... Psh. So here's a list of things that she was doing. She barely slept. Like, she never slept.
Yeah.
She would rip her clothes off of her body. She was performing up to 400 squats per day. Remember the repetitive movements from the epilepsy? Mm-hmm. She crawled under a table and barked like a dog for 2 days. She was eating things like spiders, flies, and coal. She bit a head off of a dead bird. She licked her own urine from the floor. I also heard or read somewhere that she pooped on the floor, and she ate that as well.
Whoa.
She was destroying rosaries, crucifixes, any holy pictures that were on the walls of, like, different saints that the family probably had hung up on the walls. She was destroying all of it. And it said that she exhibited superhuman strength. She would throw her sister against the wall like a rag doll, and was even said to have crushed an apple with one hand. And then Jeez. I proceeded to try to do this with Troy. And it's really hard.
Apples are firm.
Yes. I was trying so hard.
Maybe
it was like
an orange.
Barely bruised.
Maybe a lemon. Not a lime. And not an apple.
So at this point, there were different reports of who asked for the exorcism. So some reports say that Father Alt, remember Father Alt from the beginning? He was said to have reached out to a bishop, but then another father, Father Rodwick, I think is how his name is pronounced, he somehow came into the picture. I don't even know who he is.
And more tenured.
I guess, but either way, they asked a bishop if they could perform an exorcism on her, because now she's, like, showing all crazy signs of, well, being possessed in some people's eyes.
Yeah.
So they granted it. The bishop granted it. So this is the thing. Around this time, what year was it? 1975?
Yeah.
1975, I don't know if it was this year or the year before, The Exorcist came out. Like, the original Exorcist, not the one of Emily Rose, the original one. So with her, and then them asking for an exorcism at the hype of this movie, I don't think they took it seriously. Yeah. Same medical doctors as well. I don't think they were taking it as seriously.
Father Alt, knowing the history with her, probably gave more of a convincing story.
I think so. And I think that's why they granted it. But at the same time, you got to think about how much hype was around that movie. Because they even said that the number of requests for exorcisms, like, skyrocketed. And they were just turning people away because people were just wanting attention or who knows what. Like, they were probably mentally unstable as well.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. You got to take that into account with this too, because it was, you know, at the peak of this movie. So on September 24th, 1975, the first exorcism was performed. Father Renz, okay, so Father Alt was there, but Father Renz was the one that was sent to actually perform the exorcisms. He was recording these exorcisms on a tape recorder. And there's 42 recordings in total, and they performed
of her.
There were 67 exorcisms performed on her, but he only recorded 42 of them. And there are some that you can hear online, and they are very disturbing.
Really?
Some are a little comical because sometimes they ask her questions and she doesn't answer the way you think that she should answer, being a possessed person. But most of it, you're like, that's creepy. Like the way she's talking, it sounds like growly and just not human-like. It's scary.
Wow.
So you can look those up if you want.
Yes.
I did for research, but I take these things with a grain of salt. Yeah. So if you're a scaredy cat, don't look it up. Because then, oh my God, if you look it up, all the thumbnails are so creepy. The thumbnails are probably worse than the actual recordings that you're listening to. So Annalise said during one of her exorcisms that there were five specific demons in her, and they were Lucifer, Cain, Judas, Nero, and the last one was Hitler.
What?
Yeah. This is where it gets a little bit comical, because she apparently, during one of the exorcisms, was saying that the other demons, like Lucifer, Cain, Judas, and Nero, don't like Hitler because he has a big mouth, right? I was just like, that's a little strange to say. Like, what, are they all hanging out? Yeah. They were being mean girls to Hitler?
He hated our circle. Wow.
That's why I said it was comical, because I was like, what? Who says that about Hitler? Like, why are you trying to feel sympathy towards this weirdo? Okay. So her behavior was being really, really intense. She had broken her bones and ripped the tendons on her knees from kneeling down so much to pray. So she was doing that repetitive movement. So she would get on her knees and pray and stand up, get on her knees and pray and stand up. At one point, she wasn't able to stand up and her parents were helping her stand up. And then she would get back on her knees and pray because they thought that she was possessed and they thought they were helping her by helping her up and letting her down so that she could pray to get the demons out of her.
But she wasn't praying to get the demons out.
She was.
She was.
She was praying.
Okay.
I guess she must have been saying the Hail Marys or whatever it is. And I don't know. Uh-huh. But the parents were even in on it, which is.
Wow.
Yeah, that's how I felt. I was like, they were letting their daughter break her knees on the ground because she was possessed. Like, why don't you take her to the hospital? Yeah. Jeez Louise, it's the 1970s. It's not like it was the 30s. Ay, ay, ay. Okay. I keep referring back to epilepsy because it all makes sense. Yeah. But the knocking on the walls that the sisters heard doesn't make sense. And then this other little fact doesn't make sense. So during one of the exorcisms, Annalise brought up Valentine Fleischmann, which was one of her demons that she says was also within her. Okay. Not one of the main ones, I guess. Not, he wasn't up there with Lucifer, I guess. Uh-huh. But this guy was one of her demons, and she brought up specific details about the real Fleischmann. So I guess ones that were more, I guess, maybe available, information available,
yeah,
wasn't exactly who Fleischmann was. But when Annalise spoke about Fleischmann, and he was a priest from the 1500s and he was kicked out of the church for bad behavior, according to Father Alt, Annalise wouldn't have known anything about Fleischmann. And that was one of the criteria that a priest talked about if somebody is possessed, that they will know information that nobody should know.
Yeah.
So that's one thing that kind of stuck out to me that I was like, okay. Yeah. Okay. By May 1976, she was continually getting worse and hurting herself. She was banging her head against the walls. She was biting herself and others. Her family had to tie her up so she would not hurt herself or anybody else.
Yeah.
And at this point, she was also refusing food, saying that the demons were not permitting her to eat. Although she was extremely frail and sick, she was exhibiting great strength when someone was trying to restrain her, which was something else that was really odd. Like, she hasn't eaten in weeks. She weighs like 80 pounds at this point.
But if you get a boost of adrenaline.
And she's flinging people across the room, apparently. Yeah. On June 30th, 1976, so now where she's 23 at this point, she had her last exorcism. And the only two words she said during this exorcism was please, absolution. The next morning, her family found her dead in the bed.
Oh.
She passed away. in like the worst way. So like I said, she died. She was only 23 years old, and she was not diagnosed, but like the cause of death was starvation and malnutrition. She only weighed 68 pounds when she died.
At 23?
At 23 years old. Wow. Yeah. But the story does not end there.
Okay.
Because I keep painting this picture of this girl sick, right? Like, after all this information, like, she was sick. Like, there was, I don't really think she was possessed. I think she was just really sick. And so did Germany. Germany was like, this girl was sick. After her death, some people were accused of negligent homicide, and those people were her parents and the two priests, and they took them to trial. Yeah. After the trial, they said, during the trial, they submitted the recordings as like evidence to prove that she was possessed, demonically possessed. And they tried to use those recordings to justify their actions, but it didn't work. They were sentenced to 6 months in prison, 3 years suspension for the priest, and they had to pay for all the court costs. The court ruled that Annalise was unable to make decisions for herself and should have been forced to submit to medical care. And they stated that her possession, air quotes possession, was a result of her religious upbringing. So it was more of a mental illness, probably linked with epilepsy or something else medically wrong with her. And then like the whole religious upbringing just played a part in it.
16 years, die hard.
Die hard.
So that's why she knew everything.
Yeah. That's why she knew Fleischman. I think so. Who knows? I don't know.
That's insane.
So that is the origin of the exorcism of Emily Rose. So all those contortions you see her do in that movie, if you've seen the movie, is because of Annalise.
Yeah.
Because she was all contorted.
That's insane. Right now, I went and looked on YouTube. There's a ton of... I just put an exorcism of Emily Rose, but there's other videos of other live exorcisms there.
No, thank you. I can deal with ghosts. I can deal with apparitions. I can deal with spiritual stuff. But when it comes to exorcism, demonic possession, that scares me. Because I was telling Troy, like, a paranormal activity, open my cabinets. You know, throw things across the room. Just don't possess me. Don't go in me. Don't go in anybody I know.
Just make a mess.
You can make a mess. Fine. I'll live with it. Yeah. It's fine. We can live in harmony together.
Yeah.
Yeah. Stand up my broom for me, man.
Hey, sweep the floors.
Sweep the floors while you're at it, please. But that is all I have of the origin of that movie.
All right, y'all. So let's dive into our Valentine's Day mystery that I have.
You're all sorry, snotty and stuffy sick. And,
you know, I'm getting there.
We're going to get through it.
Yep.
We got two videos to film.
So let's paint the picture. So this goes all the way into Oklahoma City on March 26, 2010. We have two people. They were originally newly divorcees. Mm. It is Dr. John Hamilton, who is a OBGYN. Mm-hmm. He had his regular practice as well as he ran his own abortion clinic back in Oklahoma City.
Okay.
We're going to talk about his newly found love, Susan. Susan was newly divorced from her previous husband, Dick Horton. Susan had
two... Wait, was his name Dick or Richard?
It says Dick here.
Oh, okay.
Both John and Susan had two kids from previous marriages. They actually met each other at a friend's birthday party in 1985. So, after meeting each other, they said that it was pretty much love at first sight. The best way to describe this woman, from her previous marriage, Dick, said that she was always, wanted to be a mother and to be a proud mother at that. She had a great education and her passion was to be a good mother overall. So Susan was 39, John was 37. Okay.
So it seems pretty normal.
Right. And so they had a friend named Vesta Hall. She was in the nurse of John's clinic. After, you know, exchanging conversations, they slowly got to know each other. And let's just fast forward. 2 years later, they were married at a local country club. So.
That was pretty quick. Two years.
In 2 years. Yeah. Well, they were went through their first marriages.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Okay.
Round two. Mm-hmm. Now, here we go. After 2 years, Susan became more active in John's clinic and helped out twice a week. Now, we're going to Oklahoma City, where abortion is not very welcome.
Okay, so they're more conservative state? I don't know.
Yes. And so throughout the time period of being together around friends, family members, and acquaintances, they were always seen as an envious couple. They were comfortable in a house that was top-notch in the neighborhood. They would always have lavish dinner parties. They would have spur-of-the-moment vacations.
So people were envious of them.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. They never seen any type of, like, hostility amongst them. It was said that John loved his wife so much that Susan was just, you know, just wanted to be a mother and a wife the whole time.
So it was just like a fairy tale.
They were inseparable. Yeah.
It all worked out.
So Susan managed the abortion clinic. She worked there 2 days a week. And with the clinic being a known and most frequent clinic, they had a lot of protesters. They received threats at their home, at their business, wherever they were. Yes. Susan was never afraid with a little bit of that danger because she knew on her end she was doing it for the benefit of the people that were coming in.
Oh, so she...
Okay. Yeah, her heart was in it for the right reasons. And so Dick, who was the ex-husband of Susan, always worried about her safety because she was actively involved with John's business. But knowing her, she was never intimidated. Okay. So now, here comes February 14th, 2001. This would have been their 15th Valentine's Day together.
Wow.
Wednesday morning, John arrived home from the hospital where he found a horrific scene of Susan. She lied beaten and strangled on their bathroom floor.
Oh, no.
Her head, you know, I can't seem to get this word right. Bludgeoned? Okay.
Yeah.
Bludgeoned, surrounded by her own pool of her blood. Yes. Her face was savage. It was almost unrecognizable.
Oh, no.
Two neckties around her neck where she was strangled. So John frantically called 911 to try and get emergency. So they have the whole script of,
oh my God,
you know,
so
calling 911, asking him to send. Well, yeah. He was coming from his first job. Coming home because he lived very close to the clinic, about 10 minutes away.
Mm-hmm.
So he was coming home. He sees this. He, you know, tries to tell the operator, my wife, I think she's dead. He says in the script, I'm going to try CPR.
He's going to try CPR. You can't even see your face.
So the operator says, just stays quiet. He's like, listen, I'm a doctor. I've been trying CPR, but please send somebody. And then the person said, is she not breathing? No, she's not breathing. I don't get a pulse. Please hurry. Okay, here come the paramedics and the first responders. So at this time, the first person to come on scene was a firefighter, and we'll come back to him, okay? So at this time, you know, obviously authorities are going to be coming, and now in painting the picture, we're going to see that the authorities already at the scene of the crime declare her dead. And so the question now becomes, was it a robbery gone bad?
Yeah.
You know, a random intruder, or was it an anti-abortion protester for the doctor? Going for the doctor or going for the wife on Valentine's Day? Weird thing is, they received a threat a week before saying, you know, you will be delivered pretty much with what God's plan was.
Oh, so no.
That was in their waiting room.
Oh, a week before. Goodness.
But here comes a neighbor. The neighbor is, let's see, her name was, I think her
name
was
after
Karen.
So many years of dealing with people threatening them, I'm sure they were just like, oh, another note.
Right. So Karen, who's a nosy neighbor, but it was also a friend of
Susan.
Her
name was Karen.
Yeah.
And she's a nosy neighbor.
Yeah.
So she's a Karen.
Yeah. So then she gets interviewed by a detective and says that a week prior, Susan happened to tell Karen that she was going to leave John. The twist was she had found, well, John was also, aside being a doctor and having his own clinic, Susan had found multiple calls.
I thought they had a perfect marriage.
Susan had found multiple calls on his phone from a number. Susan had told Karen that she had found on John's call log a number that became a frequent number that he had contacted.
Mm-hmm.
John was very transparent in his clients and letting him know what was going on. Karen, being the neighbor that had known John for a very long time, said he would never cheat on you. You know, maybe you're misinterpreting something. Uh-huh. Susan had confronted John. He has said this was a victim that went to his clinic that was a high depression, and okay. She was going through a bad time, so he was trying to help her.
Okay, plausible.
But she was also a stripper. So she asked to see his call logs through his bill back in 2001.
That's a hard story. And noticed to swallow that it was very John.
Frequent. And yes. And
I mean, we're not saying anything bad about strippers.
No.
Love strippers.
Yes. No, no, no.
But in this context, if he's talking to somebody on a regular and she's at.
In the predicament of her saying, yeah. I'm going to leave him a week before and yeah. now she's being murdered. Obviously, Karen is now a witness.
Yeah.
And so there was a Valentine's card that Susan had given John.
Really? Even though she was planning on leaving him?
Saying that she was still in love with Dick. Yeah. She loved what? John for who he was and the time that they had together.
This is a novella. Hold yeah. on a yeah. second. I'm about to get some popcorn. But she was still
in love with Dick.
Oh, snap. Yeah. Well, he is the father of her children, right?
Nope. Oh, Dick?
Dick, yeah.
Yes, yes, yeah, yes. Yeah.
Oh,
so I don't know if that sparked.
She was going to give it to him.
After the fact.
In
after
a the fact Valentine's card?
Yeah.
That's.
Yeah.
That's.
Yeah.
Evil.
So now John becomes a primary suspect in this.
Savage.
In this situation because they can't find point of entry. They can't find any type of fingerprint or where the person left. How there is nothing aside from her own blood spatter all over the place.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense.
No fingerprints, no nothing. There was nothing stolen.
Yeah, see ya.
And the way John was acting after the first responder, the firefighter that came to the residence, they said the first responder was like, he acted very strange. He seemed very upset.
Yeah, because he just murdered his wife.
Yeah. He seemed very upset. They immediately put him inside the cop car because, they couldn't find anything.
So immediately while he's in the back
seat. Yes, while he was in the back seat. Oh, well, Karen also had told the detective, I did see him move his car before the firefighters came. And so part of the trial, he goes into depth of why he moved it. His statement was, well, I was going through a run of emotions. Why would I keep my driveway blocked for the paramedics or firefighters?
Why would you care?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
They find Susan's DNA inside the car. But amongst his alibi, he had to leave. His alibi was he only stopped into the house for a brief moment to give her card or whatever it was, and then went to go back to his other job to do a surgery. Oh. So the scheduled surgery was at 9:30. Uh-huh. It only takes 10 minutes to get to work. He was late. Surgery started at 9:40. So this is where everything started to go twist and turn and go through. Yeah.
Alibi is not matching
up. I'm over here like, where's the stripper? Have we talked about the stripper? Because if it's not him, then it could be the stripper. Because if he's having the affair with her, that could have been something.
She could have a key to the house.
Yeah, who knows?
Just walk right in.
Yep. Mm-hmm. So while sitting inside the cop car, he's immediately rubbing his hands, the back of his knuckles, on the mesh fence of the cop car, now making it bloody.
Oh, what?
To cover his knuckles, so if there's any signs of her fighting back, he's now doing this, rubbing it against the fence.
He's trying to cover
it. And they're looking at him acting weird, upset, mad, angry. Yes.
Why is he so angry?
If your wife was murdered on Valentine's Day, wouldn't you be distraught?
Yeah.
Why would you be upset? Angry. Yeah. So they take him into the police department for questioning and whatnot. Once the authorities leave the room, he immediately starts rubbing his shoulder, looking at his shoulder, rubbing it. And they find that odd because it's like, well, why are you looking at your shoulder? Is there something there?
Where are they scratch marks?
You? Yeah. 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 So, again, he becomes the main suspect, a part of the case. Now,
holy cow.
Trial happens, and through the trial, there is a guy named Wes Lane. He was the defendant for Susan.
For Susan, yeah. So he's defendant. Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, no. John would be defending himself, and then the prosecutor would be fighting on behalf of Susan.
Yes. Okay. So Wes is the prosecutor, and so he looked everywhere. He was, aside from the statement of Karen and asking everybody around, like, who he was and how they were as a couple, everyone was surprised. Even her own kids said, no, he's innocent. No, John is innocent. He wouldn't do that to my mom.
That so terrible.
He was looking for signs of spousal abuse, but couldn't find anything substantive. And not until, you know, John flipping out, that's where it started triggering. Like, okay, so if you didn't know that John had that capability of doing it, why were you acting in those weird ways? Mm-hmm. Well, let's fast forward to the case. John ends up hiring a blood spattered expert for his side, his piece, to say, I'm wrongfully convicted for something that I did not do.
Mm-hmm. And he's going to prove it.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so as he's the last witness testifying, the prosecutor goes to him and asks him one question. Is there anything else? Blood spatter specialist says, yes, there is. Mm-hmm. No one saw the blood spatter that was inside his shirt. And so this is where everybody's like, the jury, everybody's just like dumbfounded because they don't know why would somebody you hired turn the tables on you.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
He's saying the reason why there's blood inside is because whatever he used as a weapon, because they never found a weapon, that was the blood spatter from being on her face pretty much. Yeah.
Whoa.
Yes.
So, he spent all his money.
Yeah.
He thought he was going to save himself.
So as we fast forward through this case, you know, everybody leaves the courthouse. They take a recess. And they're not sure what's going on because now, you know, John thinks he's going to be in the clear with a blood spatter expert.
Oh, my gosh. It's
not even that.
He's probably planning his return home and what he's going to do. Mm-hmm. Little does he know, John.
Okay, so then now, let's see. Okay, so another person talks to him. His name is Mac Martin. And Mac Martin is the doctor's lead attorney. So this is what's going on. The focus was always on John, and it was never anywhere else. There was never anything about the abortion protesters, never anybody about the calls and all that stuff, right? So Mac said he never saw anything that would indicate John to say, like, if I can't have you, nobody can. Like,
right.
Being that controlling husband. Yeah. But John was that person to always be in control. He wanted to have everything aligned. He's a doctor.
So
he was more of this.
Kind of like, it always brings me back to Ted Bundy, because Ted Bundy was very charismatic and, like, likable. And people just, like, fell under his spell. Mm-hmm. Kind of like that type of thing. That's what it reminds me of.
Mm-hmm. So after having that, another person named, oh, I'm sorry. The guy who was the blood spatter specialist or blood expert, his name was Tom Bevel. So as I'm going through the notes, he tells him about the right cuff.
Tom Bevel coming in.
Saving the day. With that statement, 2 weeks later, John was sentenced to life without possibility of parole.
My goodness. So pretty much he was found guilty.
Yeah. The doctor was still in shock because, you know, aside from him, his added opinion, if they didn't ask him that question, he would have been a free man.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That was the one thing that, like, put the last nail in the coffin type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Whoa.
Yeah. So for me, I feel it could go one of two ways. I mean, if you didn't get any footprints, there's no fingerprints whatsoever aside from her. Did you really do it, or were you a part of it?
A part of it, yeah. Mm-hmm. And not saying anything to get anybody else involved.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So instead of you getting roses and chocolates, you got neckties and blood.
That's insane. But I wonder if they did they obviously did an autopsy on her, because they say when in an altercation, especially when it's something as brutal as this, that they check under the nails.
Because yeah, nothing.
It's usually... for her.
Oh.
To see if there was anything. Oh, yeah.
They checked him, but they didn't check her. I think it was because this body was so unidentifiable. Yeah. They were shocked. I didn't want to go into detail looking at her, the pictures of the face.
Yeah.
Nobody but wants to even look at reading stuff, like stuff on this, like, you couldn't find the murder weapon and the fact that he had to leave in the midst of it. Yeah, where's the
murder weapon?
He left it in the hospital somewhere.
That's true, because he has access to all of the hazardous waste and all that.
Well, the reason why they didn't find anything, too, he has to scrub for his surgery as well.
Yeah, he has medical grade soap. He thought he was going to get away with it.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. John.
Mm-hmm.
We thought you were a good man at the beginning, John.
You had it all. You had it all.
That's crazy. Well, happy Valentine's Day, guys.
Yeah. Hope you spend it with the one that you love. Enjoy everything you have with everyone.
Yes.
If it's chocolates, if it's a dinner, if it's a game night.
Oh, my God. I won't even see Troy tomorrow. It's day now that I think about it.
But you saw him for New Year's.
No. Me and Troy hardly ever spend holidays together. Unfortunately. I'll hang out with the kids per usual. It's okay. We'll do it when we're old retired people. It's okay.
On your rocking chairs.
On our rocking chairs, yeah.
This wraps up this episode. Subscribe to Las Brujas and Friends Podcast.
Make sure to follow us on Instagram at Las Brujas Podcast and on Twitter at Brujas Podcast. We would love to hear from you.
Any feedback, suggestions, or personal testimonials that confirm these stories, we would love to read them.
A question for you. Do you believe people can be demonically possessed? And do you think John is innocent?
Join us next week. We post every Friday. Bye.